Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Ewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Alan Bamberger. Now, Alan is an art consultant, advisor, author, and appraiser who specializes in research, business management, the marketing of original art, and art-related documents. But he's best known for his regular posts to artbusiness.com, which he manages. Now, as a consultant and an advisor, Alan has been working with artists, galleries, collectors, and other art professionals since 1985, and has written about art business since 1983. Alan, welcome to the show. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and your work?
Sure. That's a pretty accurate description. I'd say what I do mostly now is I run the website artbusiness.com, and I really, if I were to sum it up, say that I assist people with their difficult-to-solve art situations. Everybody has issues or questions or agendas that they need some professional assistance or input on, and that's what I do. I provide that for really artists and art-related professionals from around the world.
Oh, that's really good. So that's where consulting is not really fluffy. It's not how you feel. It's what problem do you need to solve? What challenge do you need to overcome?
Yes, it's not how I feel. It's all about the fact. You give me the fact. You give me the background information. You give me the specifics, and I will respond according to the art world protocol, how things generally work, so that you understand your situation and you know how to proceed with a reasonable degree of efficiency.
Now, Alan, how did you get involved in the art business and in appraisal, and why sort of the professional side of art?
Well, it started out a long time ago, and I basically found an old painting in an antique store, and I bought it because I liked it. It turned out to be worth quite a bit more than I had paid for it, and I decided that this is something I would like to learn more about, and that's when I started. I basically cold called myself into established galleries and the art conservator and other art knowledgeable people who I could find, including a lot of artists, and just, you know, I was young, and they were amenable to speaking with me, and I just said, "Hi, can I ask you some questions?" That's how it all started out.
So, was there an affinity right away with artists and collectors, or something about working with them that appeals to you?
There was an affinity with things. There was an affinity with art. There was an affinity with things that look nice, that enhance, that enrich an environment, that make you feel good. That's why I liked it. That's why I was. That's why I gravitated towards art and the decorative items, the antiques, collectibles, anything like that.
Well, so why artbusiness.com? Why did you start that? What was the trajectory that got us there?
I was having a conversation with someone sometime in the mid-90s, and they said, you know, you ought to look at this internet thing. And I did. In fact, I went out and I bought a book that at that time, it listed all the websites in the world, believe it or not. It was a pretty big, fat book at the time. But I did a little reading, and it made some sense to me that I might want to establish a little territory for myself. And that's what I did. I had originally used the artbusiness.com website as a place where I could put examples of my writing, so that instead of having to send examples, if I pitched an article, instead of having to send examples in the mail to the magazine or whatever publication I was pitching, I could just say, here, go on the internet and look at my website. I have samples there. That's what it was. It was sort of a resume for myself. I had no idea that it would catch on and that people would actually start, you know, searching and finding me. And I subsequently took advantage of that. It didn't take me long to figure out that this is a good thing here.
Well, of course, you know, it's evolved into what it is now. And I'm curious about one aspect of it. So, you know, obviously collectors and owners of art pieces need the services of an appraiser, and very often need the consulting services you offer. But on the appraisal side specifically, should artists also use appraisal services? And if so, why and when should they start thinking about getting their pieces appraised?
If it's an artist, if it's a contemporary artist who's currently making art, I don't call it appraisal services. I call it a price consult. And I do these with artists all the time. The artist provides me with images of their art, of course, background information, specific information about the art, the type of art, the medium, that sort of thing. And based on all of that information that they give me, in conjunction with probably I ask some incidental questions usually, I recommend a price structure for their art. I can either recommend for individual pieces, I can recommend a general price structure. And the most important part is explaining to them or telling them how they can explain their prices to potential buyers, to interested parties, in terms they can understand and appreciate, so that they can see, the buyers can see, that they're getting good value by going ahead and purchasing a piece of art from the particular artist.
So what is the difference between how older art and new art, fresh off the easel, is valued?
Well, with older art, there's typically what we call a secondary market in place. There are public auctions where the art is bought and sold. There is a finite quantity, typically, or if the artist is still alive and working, there's close to a finite quantity. And so when you have something like that, when you have the entire career has largely played out or completely played out, you have a constant set of variables. Whereas with an artist who's still active, and the younger the artist is, the more this pertains, it really is not clear what the future trajectory of that artist will be, where their prices will go, what they're going to do, how their resumes will proceed, that type of thing. So I have to price based on the moment and based on available information and based on primary market information. That is, what the artist is selling for and what any galleries or individuals who represent the artist are selling for, and figure out whether all those prices make sense and advise in that regard.
Well, let's talk about artists in particular for a moment. And, you know, we can come back later and move on to collectors. You do a lot of consulting services to artists. And the first thing I'd like to ask is, have you seen a cultural shift among artists to being more aware of their role as sole proprietors of essentially their own business?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yes. In fact, that was the idea when I first started writing articles for artists. That was the idea, that I met so many artists who knew so little about business. And business was not something that was taught in art school or even discussed. And it was almost considered laughable. And in fact, with when I would talk to the academic type people or people in that end of the business or in that end of the art world, it was almost like I was a joke. You know, oh, art and money, ha ha ha. They have nothing to do with each other. Well, they do. And you can't survive as an artist if you're not selling enough art to pay for food and rent. So that's the basis of the articles. Artists have become far more aware that it is not simply a situation where you sit in your studio and paint or create or sculpt, and then all of a sudden, mystically, mysteriously, some magic happens. You have to play a part in that. And I focus on that part. I focus on what happens when the art is done, when it's ready to go out into the public. Now what?
Well, your site is aptly called artbusiness.com, of course, and you know, we feel a great deal of affinity at the Clark Healings Fund, given our mission to turn working artists into thriving artists, with what you're talking about and what you just said. So I want to take this moment and speak directly to our audience and just say the Clark Healings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. So share this commitment with us now at clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, I want to ask you, Alan, is it important for artists to self-represent beyond the gallery scene?
Yes, and it's not a question of whether it's important or not. It is a question of that the mechanisms now exist for artists to self-represent, for artists to determine the courses of their own careers, primarily through social networking. The artists have never had more opportunities to advocate on their own behalf, to get their work out there, to talk about what's behind it, to talk about themselves as artists. And it's just really changed how the art world works. Back in the good old days, before that, people would come into a gallery to see the art, and it was almost like the art was the artist was a secondary occurrence. We're not really talking about that here. We're talking about the art, and it was presented more in that way. The artist was kind of out of the picture in many cases, but today it's exactly the opposite.
Now, you consult with artists to improve their resumes and their portfolios. So what are some of the common mistakes that artists typically make that can easily be avoided?
There can be quite a variety. I could say, first of all, the website is now the portfolio, what you used to throw in your car and drive around to the gallery and haul around to various locations in the old days is now the website. A lot of artists have, they just sort of throw it all up there and, it's like, here's what I do, you figure it out. Whereas today, there has to be some guidance, there has to be some sort of an organization so that when people, the first thing people do typically when they find out about an artist or see an artist's art is to go Google it up and see what they can find. And typically, they find the artist's website or social networking pages. And so in order to satisfy those people, those searchers, the artist has to present themselves in ways that pretty much anyone can understand and connect with and appreciate. So having confusing online profiles or presentations would be, I think, the most common.
Wow, that's really profound because, I see so much of what you're talking about where artists' websites are essentially just a big gallery where a lot of photos of artwork have been dumped. And it's left up to us to sort of figure out what is the brand of this artist, what's their unique voice, where are they coming from, what's the story that they're of this artist and the art, what's the narrative, what are they trying to tell us? You see that with photography websites, you see it with a lot of different sort of creative websites. I interviewed a photographer on a different show, and he said, look, everybody gets it, you can take photographs, but what people don't get and what photographers often don't share with the world and the audience is why you and why this, why these photos, etc. So I love that you're talking about that need to differentiate, the need, it's power-packed what you're saying, the need to sort of have a brand, etc. So let me spin a different direction and ask you, how do artists ensure that their career lasts? I mean, what should they be thinking about now in order to have a long and successful career?
Well, there are a few things. The first one would be to document everything that you're doing. Take a photograph of it, take some notes, write down a couple of sentences. Keep decent records, because if it turns out that you're a long-running success, at some point, institutions or collectors or whomever will want to explore, learn the whole story. And it's better if you already have the whole story documented somewhere, because frankly, 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, you don't remember every single thing that happened 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So that's pretty important. In terms of the career trajectory itself, you gotta keep busy. You can't take long sabbaticals between individual works or series or bodies of work. It's okay to take time off, that's fine. But, if you have a start, stop, start, stop, start, stop agenda to your career, it's going to get disjointed. And you're going to get back in the studio after taking your hiatus or whatever and go, now where was I? What was I doing? And they have to play a lot of catch up all the time. And try and retrace for your footsteps and figure out the thread, that's not particularly productive generally.
Well, I really like that first point. You know, you're sort of saying the same thing that people say to aspiring entrepreneurs. You know, you got to live as if, and you got to equip yourself for the success that you're visualizing. So, for instance, a lot of small entrepreneurs or small businesses will say, well, I'll get a CRM, a contact relationship manager, when I reach the point that I need one. But on the other hand, you may never reach that point until you would adopt a CRM software that lets you do a better job of selling and tracking your constituency. And so artists, you know, we're constantly saying, hey, you need a CRM, or you need something like that to track who owns your art and where it is and who bought it next and how did they meet you and so on. I love that you're calling out that sort of step into the role. You know, I think a lot of people, though, are thinking, you know, they're asking another question mentally that maybe they don't always articulate. What is it that makes famous artists famous? I mean, do they do anything in particular that sets them up for the kind of success that, of course, most all dream of?
Well, that's like, what is it? What makes a famous rock band famous? What makes a famous actor famous? To put it as specifically as I can, you got to keep the hits coming, and that's pretty much a matter of just what goes on inside, your creative impulse, your inspirations. Of course, there's your ability to just stick with it and, you know, spend time in that studio and be willing to experiment, try it out, whatever it seems, see how it goes, test the waters, just be bold and move forward regardless of what you think the market wants or what somebody happens to say to you in a conversation. You just get in there and do your thing and let's see what happens. You know, at some point, if you produce a body of work, if you create a large body of work, whether people get it at the beginning or not is becomes less and less relevant, because the more art there is over the greater period of time, the easier it is for the artist to make a case for themselves. It's a lot easier to make a case for yourself if you have 500 or 600 or 700 works created over a significant period of time than if you have 30.
Wow, that's really a significant insight. So is there any, let's go to the actual value side, because I mean, we don't get a chance to ask an appraiser this very often. Is there anything artists can do, or is this a dumb question? Is there anything artists can do to increase the value of their work?
Yeah, I've actually written that article, How to Increase the Value of Your Art. Documentation is number one. Here's the example I always use. Say you have two identical paintings by the same artist. They're exact identical twins. One of them has a paragraph that explains and gives insight into the art. That comes with it. It was written by the artist. And the other one has nothing. Assuming they're exactly the same in all regards and they cost the same price, which one are you going to buy?
Well, yeah, I can attest as a fairly newbie art collector that one of the things that demotivates me when I'm considering an art is no information anywhere about how this piece of art, how it came to be, who the artist is, you know, whereas if there's a story associated with it, if there's provenance, I tend to feel like I'm investing in that provenance, not just the piece itself.
Well, yes, it also, the provenance and the story and the documentation also protects the owner of the art. It offers several fringe benefits. Number one, it demonstrates that the art is actually by the artist because, hey, look at this information here. That shows it. In fact, I got a picture of the artist standing next to this piece of art or something like that. Number two, this is for authentication purposes, for historic purposes, for significance purposes. It deepens people's understanding of the work. These are the types of things that that good documentation provides, and it also has an impact on. It takes on a value of its own. Yes, the art is worth this much, but the documentation is worth this much. Sometimes the documentation, if it's the right kind of documentation, can double or triple or quadruple or more the value of a piece of work just because it has a notable, distinguished history. So it's good to have that history. And also, good documentation and a well thought out story gives the buyer ammunition with which to defend their purchase. It's not just, hey, Bill, you got a new piece of art up there on the wall. What about it? Bill doesn't sound very good if he says, well, I just like it because it fits with the couch. But if he has some information that he can discuss the significance of the art, if he can sound like an informed, sophisticated collector who understands and can offer the questioner insight into the work, that is good. People want to be able to defend their purchases. They want to be able to show that they made this purchase because of particular reasons that make sense.
Well, that's really a reason that I'm a huge fan of Etsuko Ichikawa, who is one of the recipients of the Business Accelerator program and is going through that program this year with the Clark Hulings Fund. Is, you know, she does these pyrographs and these aquagraphs. And, you know, when you look at her narratives, she has videos, she's telling you the story, not only how it came about and what she's interested in and what she was thinking and how she got to do it, but even shows you videos of how it's made. And so you feel like you're buying into something that's more than the art. But I think that you drew such a clear line in the sand when you said any two pieces of art, all things being equal, which is never the case, but theoretically, all things being equal, one with documentation and one without, the one with documentation will be worth more in the long run. It'll sustain its value. It'll travel farther and sell better. And I think that is a clarion call for our listeners who are artists to really take seriously the professional side of their art, including the documentation. You know, an example of what you're talking about, the Clark Hulings Estate just launched a new set of services for people that have Clark Hulings work. So that precisely, you know, the estate being the best source of information about that work, people can, for a nominal fee, get not only authentication and verification of the work, but can get everything known about that work, how it came about, what the history of the artist was at that time, where he was, what he was doing, etc., what this represents within the larger body of his work, and a variety of other information. So they can get sort of more enjoyment out of it, but also because if they want to sell it at some point, this really enhances the value and the likelihood of a better sale. So I think the advice that you're giving our audience, I just have to say, Alan, is absolute gold. I really, really appreciate you being here and giving that to us today. I want to ask you a question, though, which sort of pivots a little bit, and it's about the education side, because you see so many artists who don't have this practice. You said this is sort of the most common thing that you tell them, or the struggle that you see, or the thing that they could do better. Do you think that art schools could do a better job in preparing young artists for the art market, maybe giving them some kind of business skills or business experience that they're not getting right now out of their arts education?
Yes, they have to. They really have to focus on that. If you go to law school, that's explained to you. If you go to medical school, that's explained to you. If you go to plumber school or carpenter school or whatever, there are ways, there are things that you do when you're just fresh out. Here's how you work your way into the profession. You start out, you do interning here, you join this, you take this immersion program, you do whatever. The same thing has to be done for artists. It's the days of art school saying, go forth and make art, or we're above money, or that has nothing to do with what you're learning here. That's a cop-out. That's all that is. They have to address that because, look, you are in art school and you're paying, Lord, I don't even know how much it costs now, $100,000 for that degree, something like that, and more for an MFA if you're going to go back. That's a big investment. If you're going to make a big investment like that, you want some sense of how you're going to make it pay off and how to survive as an artist by selling your art. It's that simple. I mean, if you can't sell your art, you're not going to survive as an artist.
Well, let me ask you one more question on the artist side of things before we move on to collectors. And that's this. So how has the rise of the art advisor, art fairs, and other new ways of trading art affected you and artists and the industry in general?
Well, it hasn't affected me personally that much, but to have, for collectors, for art buyers to have access to a greater knowledge base so that when they do get involved, when they do get started, they make fewer mistakes. It's buying their first pieces of art is more than just a random occurrence. They're walking around with, with blinders on. When I talk to collectors, when I advise, I mean, I really sit down and ask them, like, where do you want to go? What kind of stuff do you like? What's your price range? And so I try to explain, if they have specific works of art, we talk about that. If they have a more general idea, we talk about that, like how to really decide from where you are now, make those decisions about what you finally want to buy. Well, here's how you would do that. So collectors have access to a lot more professional knowledge about how to collect effectively and how to minimize the errors and maximize the successes.
Well, let's go ahead and pivot to collectors. Before we do, I just want to say to the audience, if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Visit clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive and continue to help us bring content like this to the public. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, moving on to collectors, how does a collector know when to get their collection appraised? And is it piece by piece, all at once? Is it routinely, every once in a while, repeatedly, or at some fixed moment?
If you're spending a certain amount of money on art, an amount of money that you care about, and an amount of money that you feel you want to protect, then you would contact your insurance company and ask them what they need in terms of an appraisal in order to insure your art. At the beginning, you can, for a while, just use the cost of, the cost of goods as the approach. If you buy a painting for $10,000, you paid $10,000. That's a documented fact. But down the road, the value of the art may fluctuate. And I'd say probably every 3 to 5 years or so, it's good to get an appraisal. Sometimes things happen rather quickly, and so it's also a good idea to monitor the markets, the market activities for the various artists you collect, just in case there's a substantial price fluctuation with respect to one or two particular artists. You may just want to have those pieces revalued for insurance purposes.
Okay, so let's say I'm an art collector and I need you to come appraise my collection as it currently stands. What kind of documentation would I need to present in order to have my collection appraised? And how do you know that the documentation is correct and accurate when using it in the appraisal?
Well, I look for things like receipts from galleries, appraisals, or authentication documents if they have them. And then beyond that, then I have to look at those documents and see if they make sense to me, or if I have any questions about the materials that they're providing along with their art. I say, look, you have to go double check on this. Here's the question that I would like you to ask whomever, or can you give me some more specific information about this certificate, for example? Like, what are the qualifications of the person who signed it? Sometimes things are a little nebulous, but usually it's fairly straightforward. And there's also a certain amount of just plain common sense that goes into this. Like, after doing this for a while, it's like you develop a sixth sense. Are they telling me the truth, or are they not quite there in that category? I have to try and figure that out so I provide them with the accurate information that they need.
Well, now, what kinds of questions do you ask when you're appraising a piece of art? Can you walk us through the process of appraising a collection?
I have to see the art. Not necessarily in person. You can do wonders with digital photography these days, especially with details. But I have to see the art. I need to know exactly what it is. I have to have the dimensions and the medium and any sort of history that goes with it. A lot of times I have to see the back. Is there any information on the back of the art? Are there any stickers, stamps? Did the artist write a title? Are there dates? Are there signatures? So I have to see that. I have to say, well, what can you tell me the history of the art? Sometimes it's been handed down in the family for 100 years. Sometimes I can actually track down information which proves that story. Other times I can't, but I just kind of have to take their word for it. The story makes sense to me. So I just ask a variety of questions. And it depends on a situation-by-situation basis. With art, you never know what is going to come down the pike in terms of what people are going to tell you. So it's always different.
How do you appraise a work internationally? I mean, do you fly to see those pieces typically, or do you work almost exclusively off of photographs in that situation?
If the art is a long distance away, I do work off of photographs. I do work off of interviews, phone conversations, scans of documentation, close-up shots, that type of thing. Sometimes, with many insurance companies, a personal inspection is not really necessary. If push comes to shove and something happens to the art, then a personal inspection might become necessary, but normally just to insure the art, it seems that many companies are okay with an email appraisal.
Well, what about this appraisal by photography that you're talking about? You know, to the layman's ears, it could sound dubious. How can you accurately authenticate a piece of work merely from a photograph, let alone appraise it accurately?
I have to see the documentation. I have to do my due diligence the best that I can in terms of describe any condition issues, any maybe you have to take it out of the frame and let me see it that way. If there's a question of whether the person owns it or not, I'd say please take a photograph of yourself standing next to the piece, or please take a photograph of the piece and hold a particular a magazine or publication or some dated publication in front of it so that I can see that that's actually you, or other methods like that. If I have a question after all said and done, I put that condition into the appraisal. I say this appraisal stands, essentially, assuming this and this and this and this. I'm making some assumptions here based on a thinness of facts.
There you go. So, you know, these are a couple of points that those who haven't had appraisals done may not realize. You know, I've been through appraisal school myself and familiar with the standards used. And both the two points you're making are, number one, that there are multiple indicators of value that go into an appraisal. You would never base an appraisal off of a single indicator of value. And so it's a constellation of things. And secondly, appraisals typically have conditions based on anything from accessibility to, you know, verification or as you're talking about. So an appraisal is never an absolute. So I love that you're kind of letting us as lay people in on how that works.
You do have to do that. You do have to put assumptions in, and that's it. Or I have to, if something does happen with the art, I have to give directives to whoever the insurance company is, if an issue arises over it, about, you know, how exactly to proceed here. But the good news is that the large majority, the overwhelming majority of people are honest. That's the good news.
So what should collectors be thinking about when purchasing or selling a piece of art? Other than, of course, you know, I love this piece, I love this artist. What are the things from your perspective that need to go into that thought process as well?
Well, you want to make sure that it's going to last. There's a lot of artists are using unconventional materials in their work. And if you're purchasing work that's made with unconventional materials, you've got to ask about that. Has the artist investigated the longevity of the materials that they're working with? And if yes, how so? In terms of the dollar value, the dollar amount that's being asked for the art, the asking price, you want to make sure that you're paying fairly for it now. We're not talking about the future. We're not talking about crystal balls. We're not talking about what the dealer tells you it's going to be worth in the next 30 or 40 years, because that's all irrelevant. I want to know, am I paying a fair price now? And if so, why?
Oh, that's really helpful. You know, you run into that same thing with real estate, that, you know, people think, wow, it could be worth X in a few years. And the real focal issue is there are a lot of things that change. As we know, in the real estate market, it's volatile. So, you know, the important thing is, if you cut out the part about it being worth three times as much in 5 years, would it still be worth it now?
It's not. What it may or may not be worth at any point in the future is not really relevant. It can, because even let's say it does, it is worth whatever they say it's going to be worth in the future. Let's say all those dreams do come true. It's still necessary to figure out whether it's priced fairly now or whether it's overpriced now.
Right, exactly. So let me ask you this. When a collector loans their work to a gallery or a museum, do you have any idea what kinds of agreements or any recommendations about what kind of agreements they should consider putting in place?
No. These are legal questions, and I'm not an attorney. I don't address legal questions. Whatever the museum presents in terms of a contract or agreement, you look it over, and if you feel that it is necessary to have that agreement double-checked by a qualified professional before signing, then you go ahead and do that.
But now you have been involved in the legal side of it. You've testified in court regarding, you know, pieces that you've appraised that are contested. So tell us, how did you get involved in legal dispute resolution, and what are the key things to consider when testifying and in those situations?
I'm contacted by an attorney, and the attorney says this: here's the situation, here's the problem, what do we do? In the great majority of cases, it does not end up in court. And it's just merely, I advise the attorney, based on the specifics of the case, how to proceed. What questions should you be asking? Let me see what the other side says. Let's double check this. Let's figure out a way to approach the insurance company. Some additional examination of the art might be necessary, whatever it happens to be. Sometimes it's just two people fighting over something. It's like, how can we figure out how to keep everybody happy here and make both parties understand that it's most advantageous if you solve it in the following way? And so I'll advise the attorney on that. But the attorneys just tell me what to do. That's it. I don't come in and start, you know, it doesn't work the other way around. They hire me, they tell me what they need, and I provide them the service that they need, assuming that I can provide that service.
Okay, so that makes sense. So let's talk about one final topic today. We've gone over artists and we've gone over issues with collectors. And let's talk for a few minutes about provenance and documentation, which is really something you care a lot about. So would you say, first off, are artists doing a better job documenting their work these days? Or are there still challenges? And you know, what kinds of documentation is still missing that artists just routinely aren't thinking about but really should?
Documentation is really pretty simple. Take a picture of yourself standing next to the art. Write something down on the back of it. Write that, or somewhere on the art that's convenient, that's not going to compromise the value of the art. Or put together a few sentences or a statement that you made it. If you're selling it to someone, give them a written receipt. It's really as simple as that. It's not nothing more complicated. Record in your own logbook or computer program or whatever. Just write down that today I finished a view of the hills from the boat. You know, stuff like that. And how large it is. What the medium is, etc. So just so that you have that record. It's like an accounting book. Today I sold 3 pounds of three pounds of silver to Joe. You know, it's like that. Basic facts about the art that leave no dispute about the nature of that art.
So in the days of video, where everybody has an iPhone and can snap a quick video, you've pretty much got the basics at least covered. You may want to do.
Right, a video just as well. A video, if you would like to stand next to the art and say a few things about it, perfect. That's very hard to dispute. If you're standing there saying, "This is my art and this is what it's about," that's really hard to dispute.
And then once you get a video up on YouTube, that potentially could last for long after you do. And so what a great way to sort of preserve your legacy. And of course, you still want to track, inventory, who has it, what the commission is, who made the sale, what happens to it in the secondary market after it sells and it sells again. But this is really basic, almost like signing your art. And it's amazing how.
Once it leaves your studio and once it gets out into the marketplace, doing those things that you just mentioned can be very difficult. It's good for you to track secondary markets and to type your name into certain databases every once in a while or type it up on Google and see what's happening if anything new is going on. But for example, if you sell through a gallery, some galleries, even though laws may or may not be in place that require galleries to divulge the buyers, a lot of them are rather proprietary about that, and it's not easy to track things. You do your best, but it's often not easy to track things once they go.
Well, hopefully through the business accelerator workshops that we're teaching, we can help artists precisely solve many of those difficult issues and try to make them easier. I like also the relevance of what you're saying for the fact that artists should also, at a very minimum, sign their art. Very often, you've got these pieces floating around that are unsigned, and it's kind of atrocious for the purposes of verification and authentication.
One addition to that, and I wrote an article about it, and the title of the article is "Sign Your Name So People Can Read It." You are not going to be known by every person on the face of the earth for all time. Art moves around in strange ways. It gets passed down. It gets put up in garage sales. It gets thrown up at the local auction. It gets put into a storage area and forgot about. Sign your name so people can read it. It doesn't have to be on the front, but on the back, on the side, somewhere, because people just don't know. It's one of the biggest problems I have when people present art to me. I offer a service. It's called Decipher Artist Signature. It's that bad. And I can, get it done about maybe 10, 20% of the time, but it's ridiculous, these signatures. So please sign your name legibly somewhere.
Right. So, in establishing provenance, ultimately, is who's involved in that when you need to do it as an appraiser? Is it ultimately about who you know in the business and who can verify your findings in the absence of some of this documentation?
Authentication and appraisal are two entirely separate universes. There are researchers who you can hire to research art and see if they can come up with the provenance and see if they can find the history. I make the assumption, after asking a few questions, of course, and doing a due diligence, I make the assumption that what I'm being told about the art is accurate. That's my job. My job is to stick a value on it if everything that I'm being told and all the information that I see and provided with and am provided with, take that into consideration and come up with a value. If there's a question about whether this is actually by the artist, and sometimes there is, if that question is too overwhelming, I say, "Look, I'm not sure this is by the artist, or you have to come up with this information for me in order for me to proceed. It may well be by the artist, but I need more in terms of documentation." So these are two separate professions here. Authenticators, people who authenticate art, generally are considered national or international experts and have papers published and have proof and qualifications that they are far more knowledgeable about the particular artist whose works they authenticate than anyone else, and they can give you those credentials.
So, how has the internet changed things in terms of documentation, also buying and selling, and even issues of forgery. I just want to mention that, you know, people sort of roll their eyes sometimes when they hear forgery. Oh, that's only for, you know, a Van Gogh or something. But we had a case the other day when we saw someone indeed in another country was forging Clark Ewing's work. And so, you know, and trying to pass it off as the real thing, etc. So with eBay, you see this all the time. People are offering to paint you any famous work you want and send it to you for a fee, right? So what are your thoughts about that? What's the impact of the internet on all this?
Well, there are a lot of problems with forgeries, and it's an area that I'm pretty familiar with. And it is not only the Van Goghs. I mean, that's kind of obvious to try and do that. It's why go for the gold? Why don't you just go for the silver or the bronze? And there are a lot of artists who are relatively obscure, but who have good, solid markets for their work, good, solid resale markets for their work in the hundreds, in the low thousands, in the tens of thousands. Even if you look at artists who have sold over $100,000, you probably won't recognize the majority of the names because they're relatively obscure and only known to certain, informed collectors. So a lot of forgers focus on that. They focus on artists whose names are known, but there's just not a lot of documentation and history on it. It's easier to forge those than it is to forge others. So you have to be aware at all levels. And basically, if you are not extremely well versed in what the artist's work looks like and what questions to ask, don't go around beating the bushes and hitting eBay or small country auctions or stuff like that. If you don't know the artist, if you're not an expert on the artist, buy from a reputable dealer or buy from a reputable gallery. There are people I know who are experts, and they're world-class experts at whatever it is that they're experts about. Those are the people who you are competing with on eBay and all the little tiny auctions and places like that. They get out there and they look and they find the bargains because the bargains are out there. But, you know, if you're not qualified, if you're not informed, you wouldn't step in the boxing ring with a world champion. You wouldn't do that. So don't do that on the internet thinking you're going to get some kind of a deal.
So a couple of fun questions as we wind down the show. From the time when you first started down this career trajectory, if you knew then what you know now and could go back and do one thing differently, what might it be?
You know, I'm pretty happy with the way everything turned out. I got taken. I bought forgeries. I learned my lessons. I learned what questions to ask. I learned not to get greedy and think I know everything. But there were a few, you know, a few fish that got away here and there. But in the overwhelming number of instances, if I were to lay it all out on a timeline, I'm pretty satisfied.
All right, so one last question. Fast forward to the present, and if you could have one technology or superpower or ability to do something you're just currently not able to do with your career, what would that be?
Well, again, I'm pretty happy with my career as it stands. I'd say the one area that I love to make headway in is just learning how to research better, new techniques, new ways of tracking down the information. I love the detective aspect a lot of times of what I have to do, of the problems that people present to me. It's speaking with artists in particular in consulting from all over the world and listening to their situations. I find that all fascinating, and it's ongoing knowledge. So it's not a question necessarily of what would I want to do that I can't do. It's just like continually adding to my database so that I can really understand whoever I'm assisting, whether it's artists, and I work with a ton of artists, whether it's artists who have career matters that they'd like to discuss, or collectors, or whoever else it is. It's just like always adding to that database and understanding how things operate from a global perspective. That's the best.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Alan Bamberger, visit artbusiness.com. For more information on the Clark Hewlings Fund and our Business Accelerator program, visit clarkhewlingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Alan. It's been really great having you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.